in Vancouver here in 1998. He was involved in the creation of the Clark County Domestic Violence Court and a founding member of the City County Domestic Violence Prosecution Center in 2001, and served as DV Unit Coordinator from 2003 to 2005. He's actually prosecuted over 110 jury trials involving domestic violence, child abuse, guardianship, and personal crimes. Now, since 2006, he's been in private practice, as I mentioned, with that partner of the firm of Dimitrovs and Eskew & Babich, emphasizing the protection of vulnerable adults and the litigation of cases involving abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. Where I left off. Of adults via guardianships, probates, and civil litigation, actively working with law enforcement. To this end, he is a founding member of the Clark County Vulnerable Adult Task Force, an executive board member of Clark County Elder Justice Center, and presents, as he is tonight, countless different organizations to educate them on this issue of financial elder abuse. And without further ado, here's Kim Sineski. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Barb. So I figure if I make a long enough bio for her to have to read, then I'll get to speak less. So sorry about that. Can everybody hear me okay? I'm not sure if it's this one or this one. Volume's good?
Talk to the big one.
Okay. Again, my name is Jim Sineski, and I'm pleased to be able to address you guys. I think this is a very important group, important council for our community. And the issue that I'm here to talk about spans pretty much everybody in the community, but it's more prevalent and it's more important, I believe, for you, the professionals that are seeking to protect our vulnerable adults. And these are people who have lots of money, maybe not a lot of knowledge, and maybe some mental or physical deficits that make them all the more vulnerable. The first thing, going to law school, becoming a prosecutor, becoming an attorney, this was probably the last area of the law that I thought I would get into, but it just kind of happened. But when I describe for people what I do for a living, I always get to, and it's hard to do, it's hard to describe, because we do all sorts of different things, and this issue can be addressed in all sorts of different manners. But I always get a response, a twofold response from everybody when I finally get out what it is I do for a living. The first one is people comment on, so you're a lawyer and those are the cases you emphasize, how do you have enough work, let alone three attorneys in one office in Little Clark County, how do you have enough work? And then right after that, they launch into a story of a friend, a family, a neighbor, or a case that they recently had. And that after years and years of that happening, I started to see the pattern that your caseload may only have one or two of these types of cases, but everybody here having one or two in their family or in their neighborhood or whatever, that adds up to quite a few different matters. So just real quickly, in addressing you guys, I think it's the most important thing in addressing you guys is to answer the issues and the questions that you have in your own lives or in your own caseloads or with amongst your own clientele, obviously not names and personal information, but I'm going to be kind of going through some of this stuff. It can get a little bit boring at times. I pared the materials down to 28 pages, which has been a compilation of the interests and the needs and the concerns that people have had over the years on this topic. But feel free to interrupt me at any point during the presentation, and I'm happy to jump around and get to the issues that are directly impacting you guys. The first thing that I think we need to address is there's many areas of society, there's many issues that society has where you can pretty much say, well, that's not my problem. There's, you know, you can not be in a drug culture, and you can pretty much say when you watch the TV and you watch the news stories that, that's too bad, that's sad, that's a problematic area of society, but that doesn't involve me. It doesn't involve me, my friends, my family, my workers, coworkers. And the thing about financial exploitation and or just generally the abuse, neglect, and exploitation of vulnerable adults is that it is a problem that affects every single person in this room, directly, indirectly. It affects every single one of us. And the simplest way to prove, if you will, that this is an issue that all of us need to address is ask yourself what happens. Obviously, if you have a loved one or family member or someone that you work with or one of your clients, yeah, it's directly impacting you because you need to provide services or information to help that person. But as in the vast majority of our cases where somebody, a vulnerable adult, worked their entire life, retired in their late 60s or early 70s, saved up a really, really nice nest egg, came to and had scheduled appointments with you guys to make sure that that nest egg is safe and that it's growing for them and so that they can retire and have their twilight years. Well, what happens when, let's say you've got a husband and wife, one of them is physically strong, the other one is mentally strong. They kind of compensate for each other. They're going through life. Things are pretty good. One of them, or both of them, loses some of their cognitive abilities, and suddenly they're at risk. They're at risk for a neighbor, a family friend, even some professionals in town to have access, or they need the help of that person to access their money and to help them through life. Well, you know the rest of the story. That person who's that trusted person that's put in place goes on to whittle away and to steal or transfer or gift all of their funds. That person does what? They go on Medicaid. And who pays for that couple to exist for the rest of their lives? We all do. And that's what, in my opinion, that's what makes this issue something that's important to all of us. People who work hard, save their money, and prepare for retirement should use the money they saved and prepare for retirement for themselves. And we shouldn't have to, provide for someone's lacking because they were a victim of exploitation. I should point out, I refer to abuse, neglect, and exploitation. The abuse cases are much fewer and far between. The current system that we have is set up to deal with abuse situations much more so than neglect or exploitation. But the majority of the instances and the specifics that I'll be talking about has to do with financial exploitation. So, but it really, all three of those are issues that are of concern. I see this issue, abuse, neglect, or exploitation of vulnerable adults, as essentially, it's the easiest way to put it, as an epidemic. And I likened it to two other epidemics that we had in society, that we've always had in society. We've always had financial exploitation or abuse of vulnerable adults. That's always been there. But it's at a point now where we can see it for what it is, and we have an opportunity to actually address it. In the 60s and 70s and earlier, there was child abuse. It was going on in homes all over the community, and let's just talk about just the United States. And it was essentially commonplace to sweep it under the rug, to not make waves, to not bring it out into the open. And that, in my opinion, should be considered an epidemic. We have child abuse going on in our community, and we're not doing anything about it. And the reason why we weren't doing anything about it is that it was foreign to everybody involved. But then laws get passed, CPS gets created, mandatory reporting laws go into effect, and society, through meetings just like this, took that issue and put it out in the forefront and started to treat the kids in a much different manner. Now, just about every jurisdiction you go to, the penalties are so severe and so high for child abuse, society has said, we are going to respond to that epidemic, and society has. And there's not a person in this room today that, if they were made aware of child abuse, wouldn't report it, and wouldn't report it right away. The the every jurisdiction nowadays has a child abuse intervention unit. We have the Children's Justice Center, to where if child abuse is brought up out in the open, you can pretty much guarantee the community is going to report it, the police are going to investigate it, the social workers are going to respond and protect that kid, and the prosecutors, the juries, and the judges are going to hammer home those that are committing those crimes. Wasn't really the case before the 70s and the 60s and the 50s. So that's epidemic number one. Epidemic number two is domestic violence. Let's move up a couple of decades. Before the Violence Against Women Act money was pushed towards this particular epidemic. But ask yourselves, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, a call goes out to 911. A wife is alleging that she's being abused by her husband. The phone gets hung up. The police respond, knock on the door. There's the husband. There's the wife. What's going on here? Wife says nothing. Husband says nothing. Everything's fine. And so the police would say, hey, why don't you walk around the block and cool off, and we'll just kind of, you know, don't make me come back to this house. That's how domestic violence was responded to. And you also would hear things like, well, that's a family issue. That's behind closed doors. That's not a matter for all of society. That's domestic violence that is in one particular family. And then the Violence Against Women Act came out. We started creating domestic violence shelters and abuse centers and prosecution centers. And suddenly there's mandatory reporting. There's mandatory arrest now. Now if an officer responds to a domestic violence assault or any violation of a domestic violence offense, they are required by law. They're liable if they don't make an arrest, separate that person, and a judge has to review that case within 24 hours. Before the person can even be released. And society has said, no, we're not going to tolerate domestic violence. We're going to respond with stiffer penalties. We're going to increase victim advocacy. And now, again, today, most of us, if presented with a neighbor or a situation where there's domestic violence, we feel comfortable in calling the authorities and letting the system take over. So I think we've made huge strides in that epidemic. Now, as with all three of these epidemics, we're always going to have child abuse, we're always going to have domestic violence, and we're always going to have exploitation of vulnerable adults. But how we as a society react to it is what's most important. The third epidemic, you already know what it is. It's quite simply the breach of one person's trust over another person, and the other person is vulnerable on some level. There's a definition in the law of vulnerable adult. And we all know what it is and what it means. But anytime one person, because of the vulnerability, allows another person, whether it be a lawyer, a friend, a neighbor, a family person, a complete stranger, a handyman, any person of any type, once they create that informal or formal relationship, and then that is breached or the trust is violated, there you have an instance of this particular epidemic. And frankly, and I say this stronger 5 years ago than I do now, stronger 10 years ago than I do now, but it's getting better. We're moving forward. Society is not equipped, still today, is not equipped to handle, to respond to vulnerable adult abuse. We're getting better, and the changes are being made, and due to discussions like this and education of people on all ends of the spectrum, we're going to get there. Clark County actually has the first elder justice center of its kind in anywhere in the state of Washington and has been leading the charge in this area. And it's amazing when we go talk to other jurisdictions, they're blown away by the fact that you would report that or you would respond to that, you would prosecute that. The one example that I always give, and I used to do this example in jury trials to explain certain aspects of circumstantial versus direct evidence, but I pulled this example back because I think it fits perfectly in how we think of this type of activity. Grandma's walking down the road, just minding her own business, has her purse over her shoulder, walking down the sidewalk. Suddenly, a young man comes flying across the street, pushes her down, grabs $100 out of her purse, and runs off. Now, is there anybody that's confused about that being a crime? I think we all agree that was a crime. That's actually a robbery. That particular act could net you 10 years in prison. And the person who, you know, the witness who saw it happen, no problem. Call 911, get the police here. The police who show up, no problem. This is clearly an obvious burglary, robbery type incident. They'll investigate. They'll go find the bad guy. They'll put the bad guy in jail. The prosecutor, absolutely. The law fits the facts. That's a crime. And, of course, the judge and the jury. They all see that for what it is. But let's take that same little old lady, grandma, walking down that same street, that same day, at the same time. And while she's doing that, that young man who ran across the street is actually at home. It's her grandson. He got mom to sign a one-page power of attorney. He took the power of attorney to the bank, and he was electronically removing $100 from her bank account. That is something that is also a crime. And, you know, I'm being a little bit deliberate or, emphasizing the facts, but that particular fact pattern will not get reported and will not get prosecuted and will not be addressed for a multitude of reasons. First of all, nobody knows that it happened. So it's a crime that doesn't have a flag up. You don't see somebody running with a purse. You don't have her screaming and crying. And in fact, grandma doesn't even know. You know, maybe she might look at her bank records and realize that $100, or usually a lot more than that, has been taken out. But who would she call? Would she call 911? 911 will take the call, and they'll say, well, we'll send an officer out, the lowest priority call in the world. The officer would come out and say, are you sure this happened? Okay, show me. Okay, let's say grandma shows the bank records, shows the deal, and then grandma doesn't remember where she was that day, if that was, but she knows she didn't take $100 out. And then if the officer even goes a little bit further, which they probably won't, they'll go to the bank and find out that mom signed a power of attorney that validly gives grandson, that grandma signed a power of attorney that gives grandson the legal authority to withdraw money from that account. All these ways along this investigation, it would stop. And then let's say the police officer did go a little bit further and did go talk to grandson. Grandson admitted that he took the $100, but he thought that he could. Then you're going to hear the word civil. It's a civil matter. And let's say the report still gets written. It still goes to the prosecutor's office. The prosecutor's office is going to look at that and go, is this really a crime or is this just civil? And then even when you get into court, the complexity of proving that one simple little transaction and proving whether there was a fiduciary relationship or there wasn't, intent and knowledge, and all of that, if convicted, would net you 0 to 30 days jail. So there's two ways to steal $100. Which way would you choose if you're going to steal? You're going to do it the grandson way. And that's the most common tool that we see, financial expectation is the coveted power of attorney. And I know we've all read hundreds and dozens and dozens of these. There are no two powers of attorney that are alike. And to ask everybody along the way to understand, to know, and to report, this is a case where we have an epidemic that we aren't equipped to respond to. But that's still a crime. Theft of money is still a crime, and it should be prosecuted. When we first started the Elder Justice Center, there were, I think, 7 cases that were filed and prosecuted in the span of like 8 or 9 months. And now we see 10 to 12 cases a month getting filed and getting actually pushed through the system. And it's awesome to see just in the last couple of years that from the start to the finish, banks are cooperating and financial institutions are starting to realize and see the signs and call the APS number, and the social workers are getting out there and starting to investigate a little bit deeper. And while they're out there, they can provide grandma with services that she may not otherwise know that she can have. And we slowly are responding to it. My materials are somewhat legal and technical in nature, so I'm not going to go through all the different, legal options and case law and the dean factors of how you would actually litigate this case. But the most important thing, I think, is that we stop it. Well, you guys are hopefully going to prevent it before it happens with good planning, good advice, and putting trusted people in fiduciary positions. But when it does come up, our goal is to make sure that everybody along the line knows to report this activity when they see it, and that the system responds to it and responds to stop it into the future. So,
do you have some type of monetary thresholds that you have for these type of things? I mean, certainly you don't have the resources to go after the $100 crime.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, well,
and the penalties have got to accrue if it's, $1,000 or $10,000,
right,
or something like that.
Well, like I said, with child abuse and domestic violence, the penalties are way up here. And they keep getting, because it's real easy for legislators to pass a bill being tougher on crime. But the property crimes, first of all, if you go to prison for a property crime, you're going to get 50% off automatically. And then you're in that first line of the class of prisoners that will get released on early release if there's overcrowding. And like I said, theft is 0 to 30 days, but anything more of a anything non-monetary, the sentencing rates are way up here. Now, as far as a threshold for cases that we would take, my theory is if we can somehow survive financially and make a living, the case where grandma only had $10,000 to her name and $5,000 was stolen, it's not going to help her to use her remaining $5,000 to pay for a lawyer. But that $5,000 that was stolen from her is a heck of a lot more valuable than Aunt Edna over here that's got $1.5 in the bank and $300,000 were stolen. But the reality is the newspapers print the articles on the $300,000 theft, and everybody scrambles to protect and to prosecute and to fight over the $300,000 theft over the $5,000. So it's happenstance, and yes, the penalties are obviously more. The range for money is they've changed it since I've been out of the prosecutor's office. But it used to be $250 and below is a misdemeanor, $250 to $1,500 is a Class C felony, and then $1,500 to endless number is a Class B felony. There was no Class A felony for monetary theft, but now there are some new laws that are coming on the books that create aggravating factors. In other words, if you abuse trust, if you abuse someone who is particularly vulnerable, then the judge can go outside the sentencing range. But it's a real tough problem that we have. We have a case where a woman had $1 million, $980,000 stolen from her over a four-year period of time by her handyman. And the press will come to us and say, hey, you got any great cases or whatever? And what they want to talk about is the upper middle class soccer mom who stole from the soccer fund. And really no kids were affected. There was maybe insurance or there was a bond. And it's sad because they're trying to get, the sex appeal of the case. But there is a substantial number of people who their entire estates are being decimated and being put at risk. And like I said, $5,000 to the grandma means a heck of a lot more than $300,000 to someone who's got over $1 billion. So the most common examples and the most common cases that we see are abuses of trust. And the most common of those are the ones where there is no supervision, where somebody executes a trust years and years ago, and they may list two or three people to serve in that fiduciary role, and it eventually gets down to somebody who is not trustworthy and who decides to dip into it. Usually the dipping into starts very small and very slow, and it picks up and picks up and picks up. By the time anyone realizes what's going on, usually there's a mass amount of money that's gone. I love the cases where somebody comes in and someone – used a power of attorney and quit claim their house over to somebody else. Hopefully that didn't encumber it, but you can get a house back. We've never had a criminal defendant who, or an abuser who took the money that they stole and then invested it and made it grow. So, although we did have one that was fantastic, he came to court on... Judge Bennett booked somebody from court, and it was on a civil docket, and they were fighting over mom's money and the allegations that he stole $300,000 worth of mom's money, and he was complaining that there was no money and that he didn't have it, and Judge Bennett basically found probable cause on his own and booked the person into jail and set bail at $300,000. And lo and behold, that person posted the bail. And so then Judge Bennett did an order pulling the $300 into the court coffers and eventually gave it back to the victim. That's so rare. That would never happen. But there's someone who had some money. He didn't. I don't know if it was his money or, you know, neighbors or relatives. But so the most common ones is that you can go on the internet and type in power of attorney, and boom, you will come up with 50 different states that have 50 different ideas of what a power of attorney. How many people here read powers of attorney on a daily basis, or prepare them, or see them? Okay, maybe not as many as I thought. But and at the end, I'm going to be asking how many people have their estate plan in order, and I would hope the estate planning council that no one would raise their hand, or at least be too embarrassed to raise your hand. But when you have a power of attorney, you're granting legal authority to somebody, and you're saying that person can be you. And you're still alive. You're just unable to handle your own affairs. And so you can see how that would be the most common type of case. But we also have cases where we have guardians, court-appointed guardians, and at least they're supervised by the court. But it's almost impossible for the court to literally review and cover thousands of guardianship cases that are pending at any one given time. And it's real easy for someone to file a false accounting and sign it. And get away with it. We had a huge case where dad was a guardian for his disabled son, and he was 35 years old. He was disabled from birth, and then he turned 18. Mom and dad got a guardianship over him, and the PI settlement for the son was in the millions, and he got it over time. And dad actually worked for the Washington State Department of Revenue, but he decided he needed a boat. He needed a couple of businesses to get off the ground and then fail. And he needed an addition to the house, an addition that the child, who's now an adult, couldn't even physically get to and use and utilize. But every year he filed his accountings religiously with the court. And, you know, this dates back to the 80s, and it wasn't exposed until the mid-2000s. And that was an example of a guardian, court-appointed guardian. He went and got a bond because it was required way back when that you just get a bond. It wasn't a bond sufficient to cover the liquid assets like it is today. And I think his bond was for like $5,000. And we're looking at, you know, hundreds of thousands that he stole. And those cases are a lot. I mean, obviously, when you have a guardian and they're doing an accounting, and it's not going to show in there that they stole $50,000, used it for their own personal benefit, that'll get caught. But it's the guardians who file false reports or don't file them at all. And Judge Lewis has actually done an amazing job of trying to catch all of the guardianships that are out there and try and get them all up to speed and get them compliant. And he has what we call on Friday mornings, we call it the spanking docket. If you get a spank notice from Judge Lewis, that means you screwed something up on your guardianship, or your client did, or the pro se client did. And he is literally going through the stacks and working to get everybody in compliance. And if you're not in compliance and you're standing in front of him, you know, he has contempt powers. The great thing about this area of law is that there's no mandatory minimum or maximum. The court sits as a court of equity. And so the judge can pretty much do anything as long as it fits the spirit, the intent of the statute, 1196A and the probate statutes, and all those spirits and intents of the legislator is to give the court the broadest power possible to protect the estates of incapacitated, deceased or minors, all people who can't help themselves. So if you have a set of facts that you bring into court, and you can present to a court that someone's been taken advantage of, the courts are the last ones that need to get up with society. They're ready to go, and they're ready to impose things like Judge Bennett did. So normally, the most common cases are the abuses of trust, powers of attorney, a trustee in a trust document who is basically going to town on taking care of a vulnerable adult. The one thing that is interesting in fact, I want to give you an example of another case where any one of you here could have been involved in that case and may not have known it. And hopefully, after listening to me drone on here and there, and the next situation comes before you, you'll know to do one simple thing to save someone, save their estate. A young man was 45 years old. He lived with his father and his grandfather in the family house. The grandfather owned the house. Grandfather eventually died. Then the father eventually died. And so this 45-year-old disabled man is living in this house. He technically owns it, but it's still titled in the grandfather's name. He's very eccentric, doesn't have good hygiene, goes to church and McDonald's. Those are the only two places that he goes, and he just kind of survives. He just kind of lives on his own. All the neighbors knew him. They would, you know, say hi to him on the street, not get too close to him because he didn't bathe a lot. And there he was, moving along in life. Eventually, somebody came by and knocked on the door and basically told him that he might have a sewer lien, a lien on his property, and that he needed to take care of it. So this young man, very trusting, very nice, very polite, said, okay, what do we need to do? And this couple eventually or proceeded to take him around to try and get the title fixed for the house. They were going to do him a favor and buy the house, buy the $140,000 house for $60,000, and then borrow $20,000 back. In essence, they went to a title company. Title company said no. They questioned this young man's capacity. Then they went to an attorney, and the attorney said, no, this is not a smart move. You should get a guardian ad litem for him. You should get an independent representation for him. And then eventually they went and got a note from an urgent care, kind of a walk-through clinic, that said he's capacitated. So then they went to another title company, and they let the transaction close. And there were a lot of disputes along the way as to the intents. Were they really trying to help him, or were they not? But one day, the whole point of the story is that one day, the neighbors look out the window and they see the house is being bulldozed over. And this couple who had acquired title to the property, or bought it, basically took the remaining money that was left that the young man had and rented a trailer space in a ratty old little trailer home and put him in there, and then gave him the remaining $3,000 or $5,000 that was left and said, you know, have a nice day. And then they went out and got a construction loan for $180,000, and they were going to raise the house and build a new house there. So anyway, the bulldozers are knocking the walls of the house down, and all the neighbors were, or at least one neighbor was saying, what happened to him? And I wonder what's going on. So that neighbor did the most incredible right thing by calling 911. Just making a quick call and say, hey, I don't know about the situation. So that's hero number one in the case. Hero number two was the police officer that responded. Just a regular patrol deputy, writes tickets, arrests people for crimes, does not have a civil law degree, responded and started asking around. And that particular officer didn't quite understand what was going on. Is this civil? They have title to the property. You know, that seems right. But then he's also hearing, you know, other issues over here about the young man that might kind of trigger, you know, some radar in the officer's brain. So the officer, instead of just closing it out as a civil matter, the officer decided to take it to a detective who specializes in this area of cases. And so that was hero number two, the neighbor, the road cop, and then the detective. And then that detective turned it into high gear and went out, interviewed everybody, discovered all the facts, discovered the trail of professionals that were seen, that were visited before the house was transferred, and went out to the community and solicited, the detective did, solicited a law firm, solicited a guardian ad litem, and solicited a guardian without the promise of being ever being paid to take on this case to try and, you know, try and protect this young man. And those people did that, and it took a few months. This particular case involved a vulnerable adult protection order, which I'm going to talk a little bit about later. It's one of the tools that you can use. And it also involved the filing of a guardianship, because this young man needed immediate intervention, and he also needed long-term protection. The VAPO, Vulnerable Adult Protection Order, is an immediate band-aid, and the guardianship protects the person long-term. And this young man is doing extremely well now. His guardian was able to apply for back payment of quite a bit of benefits that have made him be much more comfortable than he would have been. He's got a safe place to live, and he's got a care manager that goes out and makes sure he's okay. The two individuals that created this whole thing were criminal charges were filed against them, and a resolution was negotiated where they put money back, and that money went to the young man, and it was a positive result. We also had witnesses along the way that the attorney, the estate plan attorney, who was involved in that case, was willing to testify and gave an interview. The title companies were both now fully educated on when this stuff comes through your door, it might be more than you think. And everybody involved in this case walked away from it or left the case knowing a little bit more about how this stuff manifests itself. No two cases are alike. There's always one flavor or another of some sort of level of trust versus how that trust is abused. You can have someone as simple as a caregiver who comes over twice a week and just kind of sits with a vulnerable adult. That can create an informal relationship, a fiduciary relationship. One of the great things in the laws that we have is the burden shifting as well. Is in all of our cases, the first thing we want to do is establish the fiduciary relationship. And you guys all have fiduciary relationships with your clients. But when we're kind of looking at a wrongdoer and we're looking at a scenario of protecting the wrongdoer from some harm, first thing we do is establish that relationship. And when in the context of gifts, when you have a power of attorney, I take a power of attorney out. Mr. Higgins signs a power of attorney and grants me authority to pay his bills and to take care of him because he's golfing in Hawaii and he needs someone here to take care of his affairs. By him granting me that trust, that's a formal relationship, formal fiduciary relationship. So automatically, off the bat, not only does he have a right to an accounting of every penny that I touch or handle or receive on his behalf or expend on his behalf, at any time, he has a right to that accounting. But if in that accounting I can't explain something and there's money that maybe it went here, maybe it went there, my testimony alone is not sufficient to explain the expenditures. It has to be done with receipts, with witnesses, with canceled checks, et cetera, et cetera. Otherwise, I'm liable to Mike's estate for any discrepancy. The other thing it does is the law shifts the burden to me. If, let's say, I say, well, Mike told me that he was going to give me a gift of, $2,000, and so I write a check using my authority as his power of attorney to myself, cash the check. The presumption, the automatic presumption when you're in this relationship is that that was done under undue influence. And the burden is not on Mike or his legal advisor to prove that I did something wrong, but the burden is on me to prove that I didn't. And in the world of the legal world, shifting the burden is a huge thing. You don't want the burden. You want the burden to be on the other party. And everybody puts their evidence up, and the judge basically determines, did you prove your burden or not? And I had a case with Judge Lewis where a niece and a nephew stole about $300,000 in cash and just monthly income over a period of time. And they also took a house using a power of attorney, took a house and transferred that house from aunt to themselves, and then promptly put aunt in a care facility, falsified the Medicaid forms and put her on Medicaid, and enjoyed the $300,000 and enjoyed the house and lived in the house. And this one actually went to trial, and in trial Judge Lewis was presented with the accounting information. Was we had him dead to rights on that, so we're going to get a judgment for $300,000 against this husband and wife. But then we're also indicating to the court they were in a fiduciary role. They were in a fiduciary relationship with aunt. Aunt signed a power of attorney, and she actually did sign the power of attorney, trusting her niece and nephew. And so automatically the transfer to themselves or to any other person was presumed to be done under undue influence. And as we sat in the court, I just handed up the power of attorney, handed up the closing documents on the deed, and said, "We're done." That, you know, and Judge Lewis didn't like that, and actually ruled against us and said we didn't prove our burden. And I hated doing this. I hope I never have to do it again. But we appealed that and laid out all of the law on burden shifting, and the Court of Appeals reversed and said yes, that, you know, try it again, Judge Lewis. This is a burden shifting, classic burden shifting example. And of course, we had to bring the case back before Judge Lewis, and I sheepishly said sorry, you know. And he was like, "You're right, yeah. That you didn't have to prove anything. You just had to prove that there was the relationship and that this transfer occurred." And so, just like everybody else, judges are getting more educated on this area of law and what you can do and what you can't do. Another huge area of the law that was enacted and is now being used more than any other area, or now being used more and more and more, is a thing called TEDRA. How many people have heard of TEDRA? Okay. And it gets slapped onto all sorts of different court actions. But what it really is it's a vehicle, it's a legal vehicle by which someone can seek civil redress for another person related to trusts, estate disputes. TEDRA's Trust and Estate Dispute Resolution Act. And it's not a cause of action. It's a procedural tool that allows you to allege what happened. I'm alleging that niece and nephew took, transferred the house improperly and stole $300,000. And then the court can rule at the very first hearing. The court has broad discretion to do anything against anyone. And as long as you have a matter that qualifies under TEDRA, the court can just start slinging orders, ordering people to subpoena, blocking accounts, doing all sorts of stuff, which you got to be careful when you do all that. But the law is there. The goods and the tools are there for the courts to use in those situations. I want to just talk briefly about another tool that you can use, and then I want to go on a rant about what you can do. The one thing that you can take away from this. In fact, let's do that right now. If you just were bored to death listening to me, which I am bored to death talking, because I'm not very exciting when I speak, but if you can just take one thing away, is you know, you get your red flags, and your radar, and your that didn't smell right, that didn't look right. You have that in all areas of your professions, and you have a choice. You have a choice to do nothing. It's always a choice. I present every client with that option, with what are our options. One of them is always to do nothing, and that way you don't upset anybody, you don't cause a ruckus, you don't ruffle anybody's feathers. Doing nothing has its benefits. And I'm talking about an example where you suspect that someone's being abused, neglected, or exploited. Or you can do something. Now, I'm not asking all of you to go out, hire a lawyer, and bring civil lawsuits against you know, your neighbor's kid because you think your neighbor's kid is abusing your elderly neighbor. You can do that, and the law's there for that. But there's just one simple number that you can call. And this has to do with children or elders, vulnerable adults. And it's 866-END-HARM. And by making one small little phone call, just like that young man, disabled man who lived in the house with his father and grandfather, that person made that one little phone call that snowballed all of that to pretty much save that kid's life. And, you know, you're not out there, every call you make is going to save a life or whatever, but it could. You definitely won't save a life or you won't protect someone's assets if you don't call. But if you do call and you're dead wrong and everything lines up and all the accounting's looking good and nothing's been stolen, what's the harm? You made that one call, and it's anonymous, too. 866-END-HARM is the one thing that all of us can do. Now, people talk about mandatory reporters. How many mandatory reporters do we have here? We've got a couple, okay. How many don't know if they're mandatory or permissive? Okay. How many permissive reporters do we have here? Everybody. We are all permissive reporters. I used to give trainings on the law of mandatory reporters to healthcare officials and teachers, and there's some counselors that are like right on the bubble of are we or aren't we? And I tell them all the same thing. Take all the law related to mandatory reporting, throw it away. Who cares? All of us are permissive reporters. If it smells like smoke, it probably is. Is it necessarily smoke? May not be. But to make one anonymous phone call to possibly... Did you raise your hand, Karen?
What's that number, too? Who is
the organization? It's, I'm sorry, it's APS and CPS. It's the hotline that accepts any and all calls. Now, obviously, you want to call 911 if you see something happening that's right there and you need police intervention. But on this case where you have a neighbor and she's elderly and suddenly the grandson's showing up once a week and then he's starting to drive a Porsche and I'm being obviously exaggerating, but... and then suddenly her power gets shut off and she's not eating and her needs aren't being addressed.